We are here for Loss and Hope, Urban Ministry in the Rust Belt. And I'm Reverend David McFarland. I'm joined here by colleagues Reverend Joe Cherry and Reverend Roger Moore. The other Roger Moore, for those of you who know the other Roger Moore. I don't know, is he still alive? Bless him. So I'm glad you're here. I'm glad that there is interest in urban ministry, and whether you're here from the urban focus or the Rust Belt focus, or just because it was the same seat you sat in for the last workshop and you didn't want to move, I'm glad you're here.
We're lost.
or in case you're lost. I invite you to join with me in a moment of prayer, not because God needs it, not because you need it, but because I need it. And I pray to open my heart to the depths of what urban ministry is. I pray to open my heart to the joys and the sorrows, the celebrations and the mournings, those big, tragic, and public events that make urban ministry, those small, subtle events that make up urban ministry. Sometimes it is just too much for one soul to handle. And so we escape. And we escape physically or spiritually. So I pray that I engage with those I serve with people struggling, with people celebrating, and turn to those who care, turn to one another, turn inward so that I can do the work outward, and turn to you, Holy Spirit of life. Amen. Reverend Joe Cherry from Cleveland. You're going to start us off. Cleveland Heights. You're going to start us off.
So, good afternoon. We're going to work kind of part storytelling, part workshop in our workshop. One of the questions we had when we first talked about this is, how do you know that you're in an urban ministry? Because I think the initial thought is it's a big town, right? And so when we were talking, I said, my partner's also a minister, but he's a minister in a far-flung suburb where, like, all the houses have 5 acres on them. So not like my church where people come asking for bus fare. Right, or they've just left the hospital, the Cleveland Clinic, and have walked 4 miles, and where the nearest church they can find, where they think they can get help. And you said, we talked about this, that your church has developed a ritual of visiting the places where people have been murdered near your church, right? So I'm wondering if other people have an idea of what makes where they go to church or practice ministry, urban. How would you define that? So this is the part where you speak back to us. Yes?
Well, I can be both frustrated and cynical and say that I'm in Cincinnati, First Unitarian Cincinnati, and I worship at a church which is maybe 3 miles from the heart of downtown at the most, but probably most people drive in 10 miles or more from the suburbs.
And there's no parking. No parking?
No, actually, they bought a parking lot 20 years ago.
Ah, see, no parking. My home church for Chicago, there's a 2-3-spot parking lot.
So repeat for the microphone.
So he said that people drive in 10 miles to come to church.
Or more.
Yes.
Involved with the Modesto Church,
So she's saying that she lives in the Central Valley, California, and Modesto, where their church is about 250,000 people, and there is absolutely an urban center even in that town of 250. So it can be, you know, it doesn't have to be a large city. Most places have a section of town that's more urban. Anyone else want to pipe in? One, then two. And what's your town?
Coos Bay, Oregon. And I live in Topeka, Kansas, which is about population 130,000. It's not a huge city, but it is the capital city. And it is next to large urban centers like Kansas City. So I'd say the issues that we face in Topeka are definitely
the issues. Sir? Oh, I'm sorry. I keep forgetting that part. So she's saying in Kansas City, which is 150,000, there's Topeka, there's absolutely an urban center over there where a lot of the stuff is similar.
Oh, I'm an urban planner in background, and I guess when I think urban, I think any sort of non-rural environment, and also not a suburban environment, so a older central city. And in the U.S. as well, at least much of the U.S., urban also has there can be a racial connotation to urban as well.
So our urban planner professional says it can be something that's not exurban or rural, and often there is a component of race involved in the definition.
Well, I live outside of Sacramento in an agricultural community that has many of the same issues as Sacramento has in terms of urban issues. And the little town is called Woodland.
I know that is. So she lives in Woodland, California, which is very small, and they also have a section in town which struggles. So I think the commonality is no matter whether your town is Chicago or Cleveland or Woodlawn, there are pockets in which people are struggling, and part of our work is to engage in that. That's part of our goal.
I'm going to add one more.
Yes, sir.
You know you're an urban church if you clean up all matter of human
You know you're an urban church if you clean up all matter of human effluence?
Effluence.
From your, yeah, that's true.
Excuse me, could you focus just a little more on the microphone?
Yes, sorry.
Thank you.
So I have a little thing I wanted to introduce you to kind of frame our work today. There are a few things that you need to know about living in the Rust Belt. First, you need to know why it's called the Rust Belt and that there are borders to it. The Rust Belt used to be known as the Manufacturing Belt in better times. Within its borders are the heavily industrialized cities from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in the east, to Gary, Indiana, in the west. It goes, middle, top of Michigan, down to the Ohio River, and it includes cities like Detroit and all of the surrounding automotive-dependent industries, like Akron with its rubber plants, Elkhart and its dependence on RVs. Basically, if your city's major manufacturing business was tied to the automobile, then you live in the Rust Belt. And it's called the Rust Belt because all of the factories have died and are rusting away. From the outside, it might seem like a pretty bleak place to grow up and live, but you'd be wrong. In fact, I was very happy to return to the Rust Belt after living in California for 3 years. In the Rust Belt, people grow up determined. They know that good jobs are scarce, that the days of our fathers and often our mothers getting a job on the line and having a job for life are long over. Times used to be that you could graduate high school, take your place on the line, and manage to have a good quality middle-class life. When talking about the Cleveland Cavaliers, the basketball team which did not win, leave it alone, Akron columnist David Gefels, in his book called The Hard Way on Purpose, Essays from the Rust Belt, said it this way: I saw sometimes an inexplicable but undeniably charming core of support for something that wasn't very easy to support or even understand. And I came to regard it not as charity or mere fandom, but something more complex, a symbiotic relationship of need. The Cleveland Cavaliers of my adolescence needed to be loved, and the people of my place needed something to love. Give us something to root for. We'll take anything. As I grew into early adulthood and observed the larger pattern of hope and loss, and hope and loss, and hope and loss, the concurrent resilience thereof, I came to a begrudging under conclusion. Neither of these things, hope or loss, or hope and loss, can live or exist without the other. And yet at every turn it is necessary to believe that at some point one will ultimately conquer, and that will be our legacy. What Goodfellas captures here is the essence of life in the Rust Belt, hope and loss in a continual cycle. And with so much loss, our livelihood, our opportunities, our very way of life threatened, we in the Rust Belt know in our very bones that at some point, ultimately, we will be okay. The difficulty of life in the Rust Belt ultimately is what makes it so beautiful. To quote Goodfellas again, the struggle itself becomes its own aesthetic. The aesthetic of struggle is hard for people from either coast to really understand. So focusing more closely on our own people, the Universalists and Unitarians, and our own history, not having anything to do with manufacturing jobs, we in the middle are often misunderstood by our Boston siblings and our California siblings because we're mostly a flyover state. And so this leaves us a little attitude-y. We had a conversation in which my West Coast grown-up friend and I had a chat, and I was a little harsh about it. So what Middle West Unitarian Universalists have given our faith are the hard couple things, like the Iowa Sisterhood and Jacob Lloyd Jones, and we're big on potlucks that have casseroles and non-tofu stuff. And even the term megachurch was coined for a church in Chicago. The People's Church of Chicago in the 1920s had a membership of 5,000 people and a radio audience of 1.5 million people every week. We in the Midwest are people who walk with determination in the frigid winters. We are a people who glory in the thunderstorms and the sunshine of the great heat of summer. In our blood, we have the abundance of the Great Lakes and some of the best farmland of the in the world. We have our challenges. We have been economically depressed for 40 to 50 years, pretty much my entire lifetime. We're a little frayed around the edges, and this is especially true in urban centers. We carry a heavy load, and yet the heavier the load, the more we hold on to our vision of a world made fair for all. Goodfellas said, like I said before, the struggle itself becomes its own aesthetic. And it's true. Our faith is built stronger for the struggle. Next year, General Assembly will be in Columbus. Yes, and we are looking forward to welcoming you with casseroles and pasta salad with too much mayonnaise and open arms. So don't be afraid to come. We'd like for us to have some breakout time and discuss by region. Please come in. What you're doing locally. And so the plan is we're going to kind of ask everyone to stand up and go southeast, northeast, southwest, northwest after our stories. It's our first time. So, do you want to tell a story first?
I'm ready to go.
Okay, so after the stories, we're breaking these groups and share our strategies, and then we're going to ask each group to report back with their top three best strategies so we can kind of do some cross-pollination. And we're going to record that information and then ask everyone to contact us to form a network we're working to, trying to form. So
that looks a little low. Can you hear me? Hear me all right? Okay, very good. My name is Reverend Roger Moore, and I'm the minister, or was the minister, at First Unitarian Universalist Church in Detroit, which is right in the center of the city. Now, you probably heard about Detroit. I'm guessing, have you heard about Detroit? Yeah, you heard that? You know, I caught one or two stories about Detroit along the way, right? And so the stories about Detroit are fairly serious, but they actually share a lot of things with any city. Even a city as small, any city that has a downtown, right? If it has a downtown, it probably has a lot of the same issues. How many of you got poverty in your cities? Yeah, you got that, right? Have issues around race, ethnicity, you got that, right? Okay. You have concentration of wealth in your cities. Yeah, you got that? Wow. Cities are a lot like Detroit. And it just happens to go that way. But that's one reason to understand this. When we look at Rust Belt issues, we're looking at issues that are actually shared by cities most places. Some cities are better off than others. Some are more fortunate. And different cities have developed differently. Brother Joel here is a member of First Church in Detroit, right here. Okay, our urban planner professional right there. Right? But he will tell you that cities are like that. But they have developed differently. Right? Detroit is an older city in the United States. And so we've got a lot of very old infrastructure. Right? And we've had a long time to kind of bubble out into like these concentric circles with little bulbs on it and stuff, right? Okay. Other cities are kind of newer. So if you look at a city like Atlanta, after Sherman burned it, right, they started building themselves as a logistics hub, right? But they've developed very differently from the way that Detroit did as a manufacturing center. Right? And so there are differences as well as similarities. So when we look at some at our stories then, we're looking at a lot of things that are the same, but with very big differences. And we decided to break you out regionally eventually when we do that. We'll break you out regionally because that's one way to do it. Right? We could also look at what industry you're involved in. Right? Are you an information-based city? Service-based? What do you do? There are some cities at this point that are primarily built around their medical systems. They're hospital cities. Okay, Detroit has some of that at this point. Right? So it's not just car companies. There's also this huge medical establishment in the city, in the city, center of the city. So that's where we start then. We look at the stories. And so I think I'm ready to begin with mine. I think I am. All right, very well. Then I came to Detroit as an interim minister from Iowa. That's right, from Iowa. Okay, the largest city to which I administered, in which I administered at that point, was Peoria, which is about 150,000, I think. But the churches that I actually served, my first settled ministry, were in cities of 35,000 or much less, much smaller cities. So I decided it was time to go, right? It's time to move on. And so I went to Detroit, took the ministry, excited. I told Keith Crone, I said, Keith, I've got to get the corn pollen off my resume. What can you do for me? He said, Detroit's available. And so I went to Detroit. And it's an adult dose. When you first walk into Detroit, first drive into Detroit, what you're going to see the closer you get to the center of that city are this variety of bombed out shells covered with graffiti, no windows, a lot of times with the flame mark still on them, right? Houses that are collapsing in on themselves, right? And you realize that this is going to be a big job, right? There's a lot of poverty, there's a lot of decay, right? And then as you get further into it, you find out all sorts of things that were kind of scary, right? Kind of scary. And you remember Kwame Kilpatrick, right? Okay, he's just one guy, but he's symptomatic of the way that things kind of didn't happen in Detroit for a long time, right? Okay, because the level of corruption and pure incompetence in Detroit can be appalling, right? So you have to keep your head up, and the people in Detroit have to be praised for their courage in facing it in the first place. Just being there is tough. There's somebody said that Detroit is a city that would benefit from being crop dusted with Prozac, right? Okay. Incredibly high crime rates, and high crime means high anxiety. Do people get better when they're anxious? No, they get worse, right? So you have a very anxious population in Detroit, right? And at the same time, they're still getting there. They're basically the people that the economy forgot are the ones that are left in Detroit, too. So the concentration of poverty is intense. So when we look at all these things, it's not easy to really understand what you're doing in Detroit or how you're going to make any really big difference. But then a light comes on because you realize that even though things are very difficult, there's a lot of life left in Detroit. There's a lot of things that you can do and a lot of things that are being done. And so you start looking for that. Then you also realize, you say, wow, we've got people like Brother Joel here that are coming in as young adults to work, what, in Detroit, to make a difference in Detroit. And then as you start to know more people and you kind of learn the community, you realize that people are retiring and moving downtown. So you have young retireds coming into Detroit, right? Now, when I went to Detroit, one of the first things I did, one of my folks told me that I needed to get involved with the Rotary Club. Right? How many Rotarians? Do we have any Rotarians in here? We have no Rotarians. Okay. Okay, all right, there you go. We have, see, there you go. We got a couple of nearly Rotarians right there. Okay. All right, we'll talk about why you didn't join afterwards. Right. But the Rotary Club turned out to be a very interesting organization. The president at the time was an African-American woman who ran the Literacy Center. Detroit has a terrible problem with literacy. They say that about 55%, depends on the number, depends on how you want to define it, blah, blah, blah. About half of the people in Detroit can't read. Now that is a kind of a problem, okay? Right, and it's a little bit big for First UU, which at the time reported 70-something members, okay, and really actually probably had more like 30-something members that were actually active. So as we kind of cleaned the books up and stuff, it turned out they didn't have that many people. What are you going to do for urban ministry at that point? What are you going to do? Right, you're going to march those 30 people out there, you're going to open a soup kitchen, right? Right, counseling centers, right? No, okay. Yeah, you're lucky if you keep the lights on. As a matter of fact, they had to give the building away to another organization just to keep the lights on, okay? We started rebuilding, though, and it turned out that what that church in that environment could do very well is act as a spiritual support, as a community of support for people engaged in leadership in that committee, or community, rather. That's what it could do. Because the people that are involved in that church care very much about Detroit, or they wouldn't be there. For a long time, that church is on Cass Corridor, and Cass Corridor runs all the way right down, and it used to be crack house and prostitution, crack house, prostitution, okay, like that, right? That's the way it used to be all the way down the Cass Corridor downtown, about 2 miles. It used to be very violent, so it was actually dangerous to go to church. You could get mugged, right? So the people who are there care a lot. And so what we did then is we started, as the young people started to move into the neighborhood around the church, we started to be able to bring those people in, okay, and create a community supportive for them. And then also realized that those young retireds were coming in. And my Rotary people, okay, Rotary people were teaching me all sorts of things about how the city works and were able to help me to understand what the questions really were. So you get connected with the people that are actually there on the ground, but not just everybody, the people who are actually in leadership positions and able to exercise power and make a difference in that community. Now, that was my strategy. Okay. It seemed to work. We rebuilt that church from about 30-something to almost 100 by the time I got ready to leave. Okay. That said, I want you to know that that was really expensive for me. All right? That was hard work. All right, lots of tensions and pressures and all sorts of what I call them side pressures, because the church itself is a wonderful group of people, but the ministry is very, very hard and very difficult, right? And churches experience that anxiety and that stress as they start to engage. But I think there's potential there, and I certainly have great hopes for what happens in Detroit from here. Because it is possible. I think the vision of urban ministry that I would suggest to you is that urban ministry is about building leadership, okay? Supporting leadership. Right? Don't try to be all things to all people. Don't worry so much about being like the Catholics, right? Or like the big Baptist church down the street. Be who you are, right? Be who you are and be supportive of the people who are leaders in that community. Support them, understand them, know them. Know them, okay? This is not a walk in and fix things kind of thing. It's different. So that's my experience. However, these gentlemen have different experiences, which they're going to share.
We talked about having success stories and failure stories, and the story that I want to tell is a little bit of both. It's kind of like when you're being interviewed for what are your weaknesses, and you actually tell them, well, it's actually a strength, yeah. So it has to do with a relationship that we have with a recreation center, one of the few recreation centers still in the city. And it's in the city because, in no small part, because of neighbors, including the church, advocated for its presence. And so there's a long history that predates me for engaging with this community center, recreation center, which serves mostly local kids from 5 to 6 up until the early teens and tweens. And one of the things that kept on being reported to our volunteers where we would go and do, well, we'd really go do whatever. Miss Pat at the time said, just whatever you love to do, just come and do it and do it with the kids and they'll love you for it. And so that was our program. And what we noticed is that for a lot of these kids, the snack that was provided was it. That was it for the rest of the evening until school breakfast the next morning. And so we found out that there was this amount of money from the city or from the county available, and we pressured the county to make it available and to make the food available to the kids at the rec center. Fantastic. We get our district is the OHM district, Ohio Meadville district. And they gave us an award for the great work that we were able to do. But here's the thing. We didn't ask the staff how they felt about the prospect of having food come in and served to the kids. And the volunteers kind of knew that they might not be exactly happy about it. But they said, well, they're just going to have to deal with it. Well, that's not always the way things work. Staff has a lot of influence as to how things get done, but also whether things get done. And so because of the breakdown in the relationship between the volunteers who were doing good, great stuff, really important, all of that is true, and that relationship piece was missing with the staff. And so my strategy is and continues to be not just the relationships with the leaders, as Roger rightly points out, but also with the people who make stuff happen. And then obviously with the people who we're serving with the children. Those relationships are, to me, what urban ministry is all about. Joe?
So as a member of the Detroit diaspora, it really hurts me to hear someone talk about my hometown in the way it gets often it's spoken about, because I know that behind all the graffiti and buildings, there was a lot of energy and life, and I know that you said that, but like listening to you start off was really hard. My partner makes fun of me because when Chrysler came out with that new 300 commercial and it was Eminem talking about Detroit coming back, I just sobbed. I was in California crying, you know, and I couldn't wait to get back to the Midwest. And now I'm in Cleveland Heights, which is, you know, next to Cleveland, and I started my job there in August of last year. And I was trying to get to learn everyone's names and their stories in the congregation. And then on November 22nd, a 12-year-old boy was killed in the park. And suddenly there was this giant shift around what I was going to do. And so a big part of my first year has been trying to figure out who the leaders are and trying to show up for things. And it's to the point now where if I go into an AMA church, they recognize that I'm the guy who showed up four other times. So for me, a big part of urban ministry is about developing relationships and tending to them, not just showing up once, but coming back over and over again so that people can begin to remember your name and to show that you're not just because the cameras are there, you know. This last week after the shooting in Charleston, I went to a small AME church 2 miles from my church, and, you know, I wore my little clerical shirt, so I knew that I was a minister, and I went as part of a representative of a group of 40 churches in Cleveland called the Greater Cleveland Congregations, and I just sat and didn't say anything. I didn't want any part of leadership, just to be there, and this woman who I work with a lot named Kalila came up to me, and she said, I want you to meet this man. I said, great. It was Otis Moss Jr., which was amazing. And so when I met him, I'm not starstruck very often by people. I was pretty well starstruck. I mean, it's Otis Moss Jr. And he said, hi, I'm Otis. I said, you know, I'm Joe Cherry. I'm really honored to meet you. He said, what's with the yellow shirt? Because I was wearing my yellow clergy shirt. I said, oh, I'm a Unitarian Universalist. And he said, like James Reeb, which almost made me cry. And he said, you people are always showing up. So after a year, I still really don't know who the leaders are, but I just keep showing up. And eventually, I, even if I'm just one face in a crowd, people don't feel so alone. You know, and I really wish I had a more effective way to make that happen. I would love that. That's part of the reason we're having the workshop, because there may be someone, there probably is someone smarter or cleverer than I about that kind of stuff here. And what we're hoping to do is create a network of folks who can share ideas about how this works. People who are interested in working in urban environments because they matter. So the Rust Belt thing was kind of a sticky way we got together. But there are urban centers all over the country, and this ministry is different than suburban ministry. Not that there's anything wrong with suburban ministry, but it's not what we're doing. What we're doing is the work in the city. And so I think this is probably a good time for us to move into our four quadrants. As self-defined, don't worry, we're not going to check zip codes. So if people who live kind of in the southeast quadrant of the country want to go here, and the northeast quadrant over there, and the southwest quadrant, and northwest quadrant over here, we'll give you like 15 minutes just to chit chat.
Where's the Rust Belt?
He was just saying, right?
Right. I don't know. I call us in a quadrant, I would say northeast, but that's just me. So, how about Midwest in the middle? How's that? I'm fine. I mean, you know, I'm a Midwesterner. So, all right, if you're a Middle West, come in the middle. And the idea is we're going to give you 10 minutes or 12 minutes to talk to each other about strategies that you've tried. And the idea is we're going to be like, well, what was the phrase we used? Speed dating for justice. Oh, trademark. So just chat with each other about what you've tried, what's worked well, and ideas you'd like to share. And then we'll gather together. And we'll ask every group to report back the three most effective strategies they thought happened. Then we can start collecting a giant list together.
All right, it's currently 3:34, so we'll say it's 3:35, and we'll call you back together at 3:50.
They're rusty over here.
Thank you. Western the
Mississippi right now.
So I'm still trying to figure out how to talk.
But we've outgrown our building. We've purchased a building in Lansing, which is a more classically urban environment that has suffered a lot from the Rust Belt. You know, there's a big auto. So I'm here mainly to listen.
I'm Carol, and we're in Racine, Wisconsin, which is like a mini, I call it mini Detroit. I mean, it isn't as bad, but it's a Rust Belt city that's lost so much of its manufacturing and left so much poverty. And our church is downtown, but I would never call us any kind of urban ministry. We're white people who drive downtown. And then and on the Sundays, it's quiet down there. It's always safe downtown. But if you walked from where we are, you would walk through real urban poverty, and our church really doesn't do anything about it, because our talk about environmentalism, that doesn't play, because the people that need help, they're not worried about plastic. And gay rights, that's a big issue for us. Our minister is gay. That's another issue that doesn't play very well. I mean, it isn't like it plays bad, but it's not what the people in our community might need. So we're not really connected.
My name's Fred Wooden. I serve a non-UU church in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And it's an old downtown church in a rejuvenating downtown, which means it's not as grim as it used to be, but it still has a sizable population of what I euphemistically call men of leisure, you know, those who don't have steady homes, some of whom are not interested in getting steady homes. And we're not at the heart of that, but that's the population, that's the resident population that's competing with tenants. Turn of suburbanites retiring or becoming hippies and invalid. So that's part of the challenge. But after it's all done, we can talk about others. That's our situation.
I'm the one who spoke up at the beginning. I'm Ken Stern. I go to First Unitarian Cincinnati. Our congregation was formed in 1850. 1830. Our building is 126 years old, 1887, however the math works. And my frustration, oh, so we're about 3 miles from downtown. If you think of almost any downtown or any main street, there's like a church row. Our congregation is the only original owners of our building. Guys, there's temples and there's Baptist, Methodist, Catholic churches. They're all African-American congregations. We're the only congregation that is rooted to our birth of the building. And my frustration, I've been a Unitarian Universalist for 25 years, and before I was religious, I was a socialist, and I'm religious and still a socialist. And I am very clear in any objective, academic, practical, on the street way of what justice is. And folks in our church insist on, and so you have to change inequity, change inequality. And people in our social justice committee insist that when we have a soup kitchen and we're feeding people, you know, teach a person to fish, say, that they're doing justice work. And in fact, I voted against money for the soup kitchen in a meeting last month because I said, it's not justice. This is, we can give $10,000 to charity, but let's call it charity. And so our congregation, which drives in really 20 or 25 miles, wants to be in that building. Our mission statement says we're an urban Unitarian Universalist congregation. But we don't really work with the people to help them get out of poverty.
I'm Lynn Garner. I actually right now live in Georgia, but there wasn't anybody to talk to over there. So, and I'm on my way to Lakeland, Florida. But I spent 35 years in Chicago, so I thought you folks would take me. But even in my experience in Georgia, Brunswick is a small city, small, like 17,000 county, much bigger. And there, it's, I've learned as a Yankee, first time living in the South, what all
We have about a 2 minute warning. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that is our time. That doesn't mean that the conversation ends here. In fact, we're hoping that if you respond to the web address, that you'll be able to continue this conversation over time. So please do the convention center a favor and put the chairs back where you found them. They were very clear about needing to not move the chairs away from where they were set, because that's the fire code, et cetera, et cetera. So if you can move those chairs back as best you can where they were. So the way the staying in touch is going to happen is there's the an email address that Joe is going to share, and when you send in your ideas, whether they get spoken at the mic today or not, then we'll have capture your email address, and then we can turn around and send the emails out to whoever responded to that address. So if you could, I guess I should let you know that Reverend Renee Rahutsky is here, and she has been recording this for the Surge, no, for the UA. And so if you could, she's now pointed to the audience mic. So if we have a representative from each of the groups or someone who can speak to the one, two, or three ideas that you noticed everybody went, oh, that's a really good idea, or that had some traction in your group, please don't be shy and step up now so we don't run out of time now. Thank you.
Thank you.
So we had, this is the Northwest Quadrant, and we had representatives from Anchorage to California, and problems dealing a lot with homeless, transients, agricultural workers with that are non-English speaking, and mental health issues, and the prominent strategies that were discussed in our small and not very representative group were almost all collaborative, similar to what you said about your Detroit church being the home of the leaders of the community. We found that this is true of these mostly small churches also, that there weren't big church operations that went out, but that members of the church went out to the community or collaborations between multiple religious groups would do things like homeless shelters, rotating homeless shelters, providing food for homeless shelters. The last 2 minutes, we had a really exciting idea that came from Seattle, which was a youth group effort, which was a poverty simulation, which had a marked effect on the people who participated.
Thank you. Let's give the, what is it, Southwest? Northwest. Someone else, please, just step on up. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Casey. I was with the Northeast Region Group, though that is not where I live. We talked a lot about particularly the issues of race in our congregations and how our congregations tend to be very white, even if they are not in communities that are very white, and kind of how we start to address that really intense whiteness. And there was a lot of discussion of, you know, how do we get more people of color in our congregations? And kind of what we kept coming around to with discussions of Beloved Conversations and kind of making some steps on our internal ability to handle race and whiteness.
Just to be clear, Beloved Conversations, right, for those of you who don't know.
Right. Beloved Conversations is a program that I don't know as much about as I should because, oh gosh, I should know more about this. But where you, as a small group in the congregation, are led through a program that has you discuss race and class and your experience and the experiences. Is that decent?
Yeah, there's been, we've done two already cohort groups in our church, and it's been a really deep process, and we're next year going to have a third cohort group. So it's a 12 or 16 week project, and it's, you create intentional safe space, and you really go deep and discuss the concerns you have around, the questions you have, embarrassments you have around issues of race. It's a really good program. It's called Beloved Conversations, and it's a UUA curriculum.
Thank you. So just two of the things that came up that were particularly interesting were making sure that your congregation is ready to change if you want people to come to it. Can't sit there and say, no, but assimilate to our culture and our ways. We don't want you if you're actually different from us. That's not a good way of increasing diversity. And to start with the question of, what is it that we want this for? Do we want more people of color in our churches so we can be like, oh, look, we're good white people, or because we actually would like to be good people?
Detroit is potentially the most diverse congregation in the UUA. Okay, there are some that are larger that may be more diverse. Okay, Washington, D.C., for instance, I was thinking about that one. But they're pretty consistent. All Souls, thank you. Yeah, but what we find in Detroit is that actually people join. I don't feel that it's a matter of us doing specific programming on that that makes them feel at home in the church, right? The church is that, right? So if you walk in and you feel like you're part of that, this is me, right? Then that helps. No, we don't do anything as far as I know. Joel, do you know of anything that we do as far as programming on that? So it's not because of that, but at the same time, we still grow in roughly the same demographics. So we're about 20-25% African-American, right? Probably about 10% Latino, maybe. Okay, maybe that much, not that much. Okay, so but there aren't that many of those people around, right? So that community isn't near us, and they don't seem to connect with us that way, right? We have some Asians, right, of various types, right? So they're totally different types of kind of, so we say Asians like it's one thing. It's not, right? Okay. But what it is that if we are ourselves and we're true to our values and we do that thing, then people feel like they belong there. Now, I understand in a different environment where you have a different base, if you don't have that base people in the first place, that might be a different question altogether. But for us, it seems that we're just continuing to attract more or less the same percentages.
So, Southwest?
That was us, actually.
Oh, I guess we were mid-Southwest then, the group that I met with. Do you have anything you wanted to add on to that?
No.
Okay.
I think one of the things that we talked about was that it's like, what if we look at outreach, or what are we trying to do? Are we looking for new members? Are we trying to provide support to the community, offer some, and like one of the problems with a church that I'm with in San Diego is that it's a large church, and it the main thing we're doing is say serving the community. And one of the ways that we were doing something as a matter was opening this new branch in Chula Vista, which was more Latina oriented, and was trying to attract that part. But we, as a church, we did not really provide any new. That's it. Sorry.
Are there any regions that didn't get to pump in, like the Midwest, perhaps?
So
with her laptop?
We didn't get to very many solutions, but one of the sort of recurring questions had to do with, if you have a church that's in an urban space, just being in an urban downtown or whatever urban space doesn't necessarily mean that you're in relationship with the folks who are around your church. So trying to figure out how to sort of bridge that gap between, we come in from the suburbs to go to church downtown, that doesn't really mean that we're affecting change for people who live in the environments we have to drive through to get there. So how to sort of create that. And then also bridging the gap between the difference between offering services and making a stand for justice, and how to create conversations where, you know, maybe it's the service that puts you in relationship with other folks, but how do you get beyond just being a charity? So kind of figuring out what this conversation was. One person described an experience where they brought in, recreated the experience of being incarcerated in the environment of their sanctuary so that people could experience what that confinement actually was and what it felt like, and that just creating that created a different conversation for folks about why they would want to be involved in justice connected to incarceration. So part of it's getting people to have experiences that pull them out of their comfort zone, and also part of it's figuring out what is your mission. Just being downtown doesn't mean you have a mission, an urban mission, and so kind of helping people to sort that out a little bit. And the one other thing was learning to listen to young leaders that are emerging and really listening to them, not hearing their sound bites, but really being in relationship with them and listening deeply to what their leadership is telling you they want and how they want to get there, and then supporting that.
Great. Thank you.
Joe, can I say something?
Yes.
I currently live in Georgia, but there was nobody sitting over there, so I had no one to talk to. So I was sitting with the Midwestern people because I lived there for a long time. And I think to tag on to this comment, there was one of our group that was talking about a soup kitchen, and many of the members thought that it was social justice and rather than charity. And I think that's where we are, unfortunately, a lot. And I think what differentiates the urban church and even a rural poverty environment is, as opposed to the suburban church that's hard to find because it's off in the trees on an acre of land or in a cornfield somewhere, is the desperation of our neighbors. And I think it's a theological imperative upon us, if we're living right next, or even if we're driving into the church that is right next to people who are suffering, we need to find a better way other than just to serve them soup. We need to be with them to find out from them where we can help them, or we are not living our faith.
Amen. Well spoken by the Reverend in the audience. So I have been spying on you by proxy with a scribe who wrote all these things down, And we're hoping that people who are interested in helping us launch an urban network will send their contact information to us at uuurbanministries@gmail.com. So it's just uuurbanministries@gmail.com. It's a starting place. It's not, yes. It's a starting place. And from there, we'll work together to create something maybe Facebook-y or more interactive. But we wanted to make it fairly easy to begin the involvement and also to provide, like, we throw the ball to you, you respond if you're interested, and from there, we're hoping to start with a core of invested folks.
Can you say it one more time, the address?
uuurbanministries, I-E-S, @gmail.com. uuurbanministries@gmail.com. And you, if you would please, when you connect to that address, send your insight, your what your congregation or your group has done well, or your idea for what you could do well. I have a calling for urban ministry, and it pains me to know that even in my relatively short tenure, there's a urban congregation in our district that moved to the suburb. We tell the story a lot about us being the church that stayed, and we have been able to do amazing work just because we're present. And being present isn't always easy. And that's part of why we need each other, to support each other, to help us get through rough patches, to give us ideas and inspire us when we are flagging. And I deeply appreciate your answering this, one of the few GA workshops that address urban ministry. And what we're hoping for this last section is for you to think about something that you not just can, not just will, but shall do. Some different way of doing or being, or something that you heard today that you want to say an amen to or reiterate, something, some take-home message, some actionable step that is going to strengthen your work in your community, your worship in your congregation, that is going to move you a little further along the path to what I am willing to call beloved community.
Even though I have no idea what they are, I'm going to look at the Rotarians.
Going to look at the Rotarians. Sounds like you want to say a quick.
If this group was meeting in 2005, much less 1995, you would have needed a bigger room. We Unitarian Universalists have been moving to the suburbs since 1950. I mean, if you look at the history of our movement, yeah, we've been moving to the suburbs for probably 75 years. I have a dream that I would like to become a hope that may be impossible to become a reality. I'm on a social justice committee. Committee kind of reports to the board. Congregation has to take action. I think that if I presented, and I can and will present at a committee meeting, that we consider and go through an internal process of making a decision to find a partner church. I'm the guy near downtown Cincinnati. If we found a partner African-American church and presented that to the congregation and had them have a conversation. Do we want to have a partner African-American church within a mile or two or three of us? And then it could be 2 or 3 years, and we actually developed a real relationship, especially if we had our young people and their young people, which, and then our music and their music, things. My dream and hope, I don't think, will become reality.
All right. So pursuing a dream of partnering on a deeper level. And I always like telling the little factoid that the conversations between the Unitarians and the Universalists started in about 1860, about merging. And the first thing that we did together was write a hymn book together. And the second thing was getting the youth together. And then 100 years after, we officially figured out how to be together. So it's a long haul process. So again, just quick little one, two things. If you want to say it from your seat, I'll repeat it into the mic so that it can be heard. So bringing and living a theology of hope. Anyone else? Yes.
I think I want to kind of clarify something I said earlier.
Okay.
It's not about the programming that you have in your church. It's about your individual commitment to processing your privilege.
Okay. So I'm going to turn that into an I statement for you, and you're going to go home and be more clear.
So what I'm going to go home and do is learn more about how my whiteness functions as a way to give me more power in the world and how I can use that to tear down the construct of whiteness and racial inequality.
So get more in touch with your personal privilege and how to use the power to deconstruct white supremacy and white supremacist assumptions and institutions.
I'm going to personally invite our church leadership to show up at community events.
Personally, make the personal invitation to church leaders to show up, please.
I would say connecting with community leaders that's already been lifted up, but asking them how the church can be of support to whatever it is that they're doing. So if it's in the need of space, if it's whatever, and the other thing that I want to lift up is looking into those beloved conversations. I haven't heard much about it. I'm new to UU as well.
Okay.
But I think racial discussion, the tense around race, the time is very ripe right now to have those conversations.
Yeah.
And churches need to be a space for all people to process what's going on, whether you're white or black.
Great.
So I think really thinking about how you can take that, reimagining
great. So bringing back Beloved Conversations, is that right? Is that the right name? Beloved Conversations. And engaging with the leaders, first identifying them, but really being in relationship and asking, making the ask, what is it? How is it that we can be supportive of your efforts? Because I think there's a general agreement that most of our churches cannot do it alone, and in my opinion, as a Universalist, nor should we, even if we can. Anything else before Roger closes us out with prayer? A couple more, yeah.
We have an escalating inequality study group, not just for our congregation, but for other congregations.
right. So connecting with the group that already exists, there's a couple of levels. Moving it from discussion to action. Any UUA men out there for that? And what was the second part? Right, and not only reaching deeper into the inner city, but also connecting with the suburban churches and recognizing the regionalism that the suburban churches absolutely depend on the city as well. And then there was another? All right. All right. So not just going yourself, but actually making the personal ask, not just saying there's a clipboard over here, but walking around with a clipboard and making the personal request. Yes, please, in the back. And that'll be our last one. Okay, so if I can encapsulate that, that's focusing resources, not just
very much specific, very much more specific. Ask your own congregation to use at least part of its Sunday offering to hand back to the community to serve the community on its terms, not on your own.
Yeah. So. Right. So
actively good things going on in every bad community, and supporting them is something we can do more effectively than others.
So supporting the people and the organizations that are doing the good work, not least of which through sharing the offering on a regular basis. All right. So thank you all for your participation. And Roger is going to close us out with a prayer.
Let's take a moment to just breathe. Relax, close your eyes. Center yourself and reconnect. Thank you. Please feel free to join me in a spirit of communion or community for a benediction. Beloved, we give thanks today for the opportunity to join together. Thanks for each and every person in this room, for the love and the caring that they bring to the questions that affect our cities and our nation, our planet. We give thanks for the wisdom that we've gathered, for those who are learning and growing and looking for solutions, we give thanks. We forgive ourselves for the times when we have fallen short and challenge ourselves to move forward in love and in reason. With all of that, we give thanks for the privilege and the opportunity to be part of this movement, for the history that we share, and for all that we may yet build together. In the name of this room, and in the name of our faith, I pray. Amen.
salvation. They think they're helping others. But
there's a phrase that I call well.
So the organization
works well. It's hard to be religious.
It is. That's why it's hard to do well.
Well, thanks for doing this.
Absolutely.
It's horrible.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was never great, obviously, but in the city it was okay, and then, but it was really gutted under me.
That was the old and in with you, or something like that.
It's all yours.
Test.